The following message was recorded at the 2010 No Regrets Men's Conference. More information about the No Regrets Men's Conference is available at www.noregrets.org. Feel free to make copies of this message for others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. And now, our featured presentation.
Welcome, everybody. Dan, and this is the final seminar, and then we'll go back to the main session after this. And I'm proud to introduce Dan Green. You're in for a treat. I heard him the first time, and he does a great job. He's married and has a son and a daughter, and he has a son-in-law and a grandson. So he's got good life experiences. He's got 25 years at Elmbrook Church, and he also is a psychologist, licensed psychologist, and with a lot of experience. You're in for a treat, like I said.
Well, good afternoon. In the next 15 minutes, I'm going to try to share some thoughts on healing the wounds from our past. This is a daunting topic. This is a huge topic. What I'm hoping to do in this time is to give you an overview, to take you through a process of what it would look like and what's required for us to heal these wounds. And as we consider this, I'm going to start with this the idea of why do we do what we do? Why do we do what we do? And on the screen here, I'm a visual person. I always like to see something. On the screen, a picture of an iceberg. And as you'll see, while the top, that's what's exposed, may be massive, what's not exposed is even greater. Why do we do what we do? Well, I recognize as I was driving in today, I was with my son. We're both in the car together, and we're listening to music, and we're talking, and I'm eating breakfast, and I'm drinking coffee, and I'm making life and death decisions at the same time. I honestly don't have much of a memory at all of driving in. I got here, obviously, but a lot of that behavior was automatic. I did not think, let's see, Shell answer book, next you're supposed to straighten the car out, now adjust because we hit a bump. No, this is all being processed very routinely, very automatically. Frankly, a great deal of our behavior is automatic. A great deal of our experience happens out of our intention and out of our awareness. Things influence us that we've learned before. Things influence us that we've done before and we've rehearsed, we've observed, we've been a part of. As we try to understand why we do what we do, we develop all types of theories. Here's one I'd like you to consider. The little devil on the left says, it was my alcoholic father, my bipolar mother, and poverty-stricken environment that turned me bad. To which his co-partner in this crime responds, really? I just have evil DNA. Is it my environment? Is it my genetics? Or another way that we'll describe this is it my personality? And there are all kinds of different personality organizations. My son showed me this one. He particularly likes the last one. The first one, the type of personality, my glasses half full, the glasses half empty. A third option, half full. No, wait, half empty. No, half, what was the question? And then finally, hey, I ordered a cheeseburger. Different ways of responding to the same situation. Is it my personality that causes me to do what I do? Why do we do what we do? Well, I'm going to suggest all of the above. Certainly our genetics are a very big part of it. We're told by the psalmist that while we're developing in our mother's womb, we're being knit together. We're known even at that point. There is an essence of a person forming. I have a 6.5-week-old grandson. I could spend the rest of the time there. I won't go to those pictures. I have a 6.5-week-old grandson that already you see facial expressions that are very unique to him. You see responses in the first couple of weeks. He came the person that he is. Genetics is a big part of it. We learn through modeling. We observe. We see how others do it. Where do we learn how to be a big person? Well, we learn it when we're a little person, and we learn an awful lot of it by watching and observing and being a part of our family of origin, the culture that we live in, the environment that we're in. We also, modified by reinforcement and punishment, good grades, sports trophies, academic medals, whatever it might be, these type of rewards, it might be attention, it might be monetary, it might be symbolic, those kind of things can motivate us to prompt us to do what we do. Our culture at large, particularly in mass media cultures, it provides all types of modeling. It defines for us in so many ways what is normal, how we should act, how we should look. All these types of things influence us. And then there's the supernatural. Now, some of you were old enough to remember when Flip Wilson was on TV, and he used to have this phrase, "The devil made me do it." And in essence, that was, "Oh, I got caught. I don't want it to be my responsibility." Sometimes people look at their life that way, that when they do something that they don't like, well, that's the devil made me do it. When they do something that they do like, well, that was me, thanks. I'm pretty good. What is the supernatural influence? There's some things that we know, there's an awful lot that we don't. But one thing that we do know, if I'm going to understand why I do what I do, if I'm going to understand what drives me, what motivates me, I have to factor in the reality of the world that I live in. Now, when we look back at how we were designed to be, when we look back at the original design of the human being, we see a wonderful, beautiful passage in Genesis chapter 2, verse 25. It says, "They were naked and they felt no shame." We are designed for nakedness. Clearly, the Garden of Eden was not in Wisconsin in February. We were designed for not just physical nakedness, which creates its own challenges for a lot of us, but for emotional, mental, spiritual, relational openness. No covering, no hiding, no secrets. This is what we're designed for. This is what we long for. Those of us who are fathers, I would be pretty confident in saying nobody in this room had to teach their child the concept of fairness. Children somehow know that, and they usually know it by, "That's not fair." And that's a culturally universal cross-culture experience. There's something inside us that longs for that closeness, that deeply being known, accepted, unconditional love, justice, righteousness, fairness. We seek it. But we find very little of it. And the 2-year-old has got this figured out. "Wait a minute. It's not supposed to be this way. I said I want it." What's not clear about that? That is our human experience. We get a little more sophisticated as we get older, but frankly, often not that much more sophisticated. We are desiring the garden, and we've lost it. Now, sometimes we can identify the pain in our life, the struggles that we have, based on sin that I'm responsible for. I lied, and then I had to lie to cover up that lie, and then I was getting caught in that lie, and I forgot quite what the story was, and I got caught, and now I'm not trusted. I see how I set this whole problem up. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes we are wounded by the sins of others. Reality is not all about me. It's hard to accept sometimes, but that's the reality. There is a host of others around me that also have their own wills, their own choices, and they are as fallen and fallible as I am. Consequences of their behaviors also impact me. Not just my choices, their choices. I may be wounded, I may be hurt or damaged by actions taken by others. They may have intended harm or evil. They may have intended good, but harm still occurred. Sometimes the wounds that we have are the result of the actions of others. Sometimes, though, the wounds that we encounter are the consequences of living in a fallen world. This world isn't fair. This world isn't just. So much around us is not loving. I'm reminded of a time when my son was, back when he was in junior high, and he was climbing up on his loft to go to bed that night, and junior high is the worst time of life for a lot of us. That was a horrible day for him. And what had happened that day is he had been bullied, and then he had treated his friend very poorly. And he felt horrible about what happened to him, and he felt horrible about what happened to his friend. And it was too overwhelming for this little sixth grade mind. And partway up his ladder, he turned at me and looked, and he said, "Don't you just hate sin?" "Yeah, I guess I do." Sometimes we have the experience that the Apostle Paul has. Maybe all the time we're having the experience the Apostle Paul had. I don't do the things I want to do, and the things I want to do, I don't do. We're in this battle, and it's not just me, and it's not even just the people around me. It's the whole reality that we're in. The whole reality wounds us, and the consequences are not just from others even, all of the fallenness around us. The problem then ultimately, we're struggling living in a fallen world when we're designed and we desire to live in a perfect world. Bottom line, all of us have been wounded. All of us have been scarred. Not one of us got through middle school unscathed, let alone the rest of life. My children have been wounded in their development, in their young adulthood. My grandson at 6 weeks, he hasn't had it perfect yet. Pretty good, but not perfect yet. We can't have what we long for. And the consequence is wounds happen. Losses happen. Everyone experiences this. Now, in considering how to address this huge topic, healing the wounds of the past, let's take a look at some of the concepts in it. What do we mean by past? That's probably kind of self-evident, but here's a dictionary definition. Portion of time that has already occurred, the opposite of the future. I like that. Well, it's over, so why should I bother with it? Well, I didn't have to this morning when I got into my car all of a sudden read a book very quickly so I knew how to drive. I've been doing that for many decades. My prior learning experiences equipped me to know what to do right now. And in the same way, all of us learned how to be big people when we were little people. And we don't have to relearn, reinvent the wheel every time we encounter a situation. We have this reservoir, this repertoire of possible responses, options that we can engage in. And some of them are very helpful, and some of them are, frankly, quite unhelpful or impairing. So we're going to draw upon our life experiences, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But the question then often comes, well, are we living in the past? I'll give you an example. A man I know, about 50, 55 years old at this point, when he was 13, his dad suddenly died. Just taken from him instantly. And all of a sudden, he was the quote-unquote man in the family, but because his mother was not well prepared for this, I don't know how you could ever be prepared for your spouse to go so instantly, she was quite depressed. She was incapacitated. He all of a sudden had the experience of losing both his parents functionally. And then he had younger siblings, and mom was incapacitated. And he felt like he was the mother and father to the young ones. But he felt overwhelmed because he's 13. He wasn't equipped to do the adult world. Now, this gentleman, when I meet him today, or several years ago when I first met him, he shared with me that when life gets very stressful, all of a sudden he feels like he's 13 again. He feels like He's a little kid in an adult world, and it's all on him, and he doesn't know what to do. Now, he's about 6'6", 260 pounds. He doesn't look like a little kid. He has adult responsibilities. You look at him, others see him doing really well. Inside, he's scared, struggling with inadequacy, afraid. Is he living in the past? Well, on the one hand, we would say no. We can only live in the present. The way human beings function, we can remember the past, we can imagine the future, but all we can really operate on is this moment in time. Well, that moment's gone. Now we're in this moment. We could do this continually. We only can live in the present. But in another way, yes, we can continue to operate with the strategies and the rules and the expectation and the roles, the way we lived at different places in our history. We can continue to operate with those strategies. We can continue to experience ourselves as if we are at a different place in life. I was hiking with some college friends recently, and she asked me an interesting question. Inside, how old do you feel? Let me ask each of you to just consider. You don't need to say anything. Just consider. Well, I answered, I feel like I'm about 25. My knees may be 70, but me, about 25. And she laughed. She goes, that's what other people are saying. I can assure you, I have children older than 25. But how we see ourselves is not always lined up real well with who we are and where we are in life. Furthermore, as we are stressed, as we have demands placed on us, things become very difficult for us. We tend to go back to old strategies we used before. So, do I live in the past? Well, I can only live in the present. However, I can live as if I'm in the past. Not because I want to, but because automatically I go back to a place where I have unresolved concerns, where I'm emotionally very active and stuck, where there's a lot of pain that I haven't been able to get past. And when I'm stressed, that tends to be the way that I function. And we can see very mature people regress back very quickly. This is a famous quote that's used in a lot of different settings. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And this gentleman that I'm sharing with you about, who lost his dad when he was 13, he didn't have time to grieve the loss because there was nobody to take care of him or his siblings. And what he shared with me was, I did the best I could, and I just got going. He figured out how to do the Social Security administrative stuff. He got a paper out to help supplement. He cooked. But he never adjusted to the loss. It was immediately hit the ground running. And he didn't want to remember the past. But he felt trapped. He felt as if he were 13, overwhelmed with life. When we consider a process of healing, I'm going to use the metaphor of the physical wound for the spiritual, mental, emotional, relational wounds. We've all seen pictures of the devastation in Haiti. I've been in regular contact with several Haitian doctors and medical clinics be down there pretty quickly. And what I see them doing in these photographs they're sending me looks like MASH from the old TV series, except they don't have tents over them. They didn't have that good of equipment. There's wounds with bones sticking out and blood all over and bones that are crushed. These wounds, they're obvious just looking at them. Now, when we think about emotional or mental or relational, psychological wounds, spiritual wounds, they're a lot harder to see. In fact, as a student of mine in the Czech Republic once stated, we Christians, we wear our Sunday faces with each other. We look like everything is good. We look like we have it all together. We don't want you to know what it's really like to be me, because that would indicate I don't have very much faith. That would indicate I'm not a good Christian. So I look like I have no wounds. Of course, here's the guy next to you who sees that you have no wounds. He knows he has them. He's either a complete loser or he's got to figure out how to do what you're doing. And we build walls between each other. So to identify the wounds, we're going to have to look on the inside. We're going to have to look at where do we get blocked? What interferes with our capacity to love and be loved? What interferes with our capacity to have contentment and peace? What blocks us from a clear conscience? One of the events that occurred many times in my office is a pastor, a Bible study leader, church leader, has said, I teach about the love of Jesus. I know the love of God. I see it in other people's lives. I see their joy. And I know it's true, but it doesn't apply to me. I don't have a clue how to experience that. I see these other people with contentment, and I'm jealous. But of course, if I let my elder board know that, I'll probably get fired. So I keep it secret. I stay alone. Quite often, the wound is so secret, it's even difficult for me to acknowledge. But once we identify the wound, then we're going to have to clean it. And cleaning wounds is not pleasant. Years ago, I was running around playing on a beach on the West Coast, Pacific Northwest. I jumped off a log right onto a broken beer bottle, such that the bottle implanted itself in my foot and stuck. It was deep. And we didn't take it out. They take me to the hospital. I get to the hospital, and they're going to now clean it. I think they got out a blowtorch and some other tools to help them with this job. It was excruciating. I really wanted them, just leave it there. I'll get used to it. You know, I don't want to go through this pain. But had they left it there, what would have happened? Infection, eventually death. Okay, death, the pain of going through it. Give me some time here. I'm thinking. That's a hard one because the death is later, but the pain is right now. We are so motivated to avoid pain. But we're going to be looking at when we go to clean the wound, we have to go through the pain. And then once we have cleaned, gotten out what doesn't belong there, the wound now is clean. We need to protect it and bandage it so it can heal. We're going to need to put protection around it, giving it a chance to heal. And then once the healing has occurred, they take off the bandage, remove the cast. And if you've ever been in physical therapy, yeah, physical torture as we call it, PT, exercise it. Oh, that just doesn't feel right. But after we build up the strength by exercising, all of a sudden it develops into this is right. This is how it's supposed to be. Well, this is the process I want to describe to you in the next few minutes. So this idea of healing, what are we going to go towards? Well, a lot of people would like to go towards perfection. I want to be perfect. And I had some pain in my life. I've had this wound, and this wound has kept me from being perfect. Well, that wound plus reality. Bottom line, our goal is not on this earth to be God. There is a God. We're not it. We're not going to be it. Sometimes people want to heal, and their image of healing is, I will be all sufficient myself. I will have no needs. I will be completely self-sufficient. I will be John Wayne, or whatever that image might be today. The general idea of healing is restore to health, but what are we going to restore to? If a person wounded when they were quite little, they may have no sense of what life would be like without that abuse having happened. What will it look like? Well, I'm going to ask us to think of two things. One, how we were designed, naked and not ashamed, completely open. This is what we long for. We don't get it in its entirety in this earth. We'll never have those relationships on this earth that are without risk. Every relationship is risky, and every relationship that we enter into, we are taking a risk that we will get hurt. There is no other option with human beings. That can't be our goal. What is our healing going to look like? Well, I'm going to go through a list here. I'm going to go through it rather quickly, suggesting what the healing may result in. What does a well-functioning Christian person, what are their characteristics? What do they look like? Well, they live in peace, in the realization and acceptance of both their past, present, and realistic hope for their future. They can accept their own story. They're able to spontaneously experience their thoughts, their own interpretations, their emotional reactions. They're able to adapt and adjust to the reality of the situation. They're able to be present. They can identify, accept, and manage their own needs, including their dependencies. They can submit themselves to God with reverence of God and acceptance of themselves, able to extend and give themselves in service to others. They're relational. Can choose to submit themselves to another with full respect for themselves and their other. Often for us, it's challenges around authority figures. Can receive forgiveness from God, others, and self, and offer forgiveness to others and themselves. And the research shows that the hardest person for us to forgive, myself. Outcome of healing is we live in a state of forgiveness, including releasing ourselves. One can realistically discern responsibility, separating themselves from others, and effectively manage areas of responsibility, their personal life, their family, their work. Allow themselves intimacy with others, revealing themselves and receiving and accepting others, while maintaining a clear sense of who I am and who you are. Being able to have intimacy, knowing and being known. Accept themselves realistically. Accept themselves as God sees them, with a cohesive sense of myself. A person of great value, with the sin nature, who God loves and desires and wants to be in relationship with and wants to redeem. Motivated by love, to seek and do good towards loved ones. We could sum this up, loves God with all heart, our soul, our mind, loves others as we love ourselves. How many of you are here already? Three of us, okay. Now, this is what we're designed to go towards. And we continually will heal and grow. It's a process. It's not an arriving destination. But it's also important to recognize what healing is not. Healing is not the absence of pain, conflict, struggle, disappointment, or hurt. Many people hide their pain, their disappointments, their hurt. They don't want to look like they haven't arrived. But in honesty, none of us do. Healing is not feeling good or being happy. With enough substance, we can be happy in about any state. It doesn't give us indication of healing. It gives us indication of the emotional moment. Very temporary. It is not the absence of shame or anger or fear. Unresolved shame can cripple us. The absence of shame results in a sociopath. Don't want one of those for a neighbor. The absence of anger leaves us completely helpless. The misuse of anger can be completely destructive. We need anger. We need shame for those things which we need to avoid, to come away from. We need fear for that which is danger. That is not an indication of healing. It's not ignoring or denying the past or the consequences of behavior. It's not saying, well, they meant well. Well, that might be accurate. They may have meant well, but the damage may be here. It's not pretending what's not real. And it's certainly not being perfect. It's not being without need. It's not being non-human. Healing is going to be evident. Living well is going to be evident in being able to live in the truth of who we actually are. So, let's go now and look at the process. First thing we're going to do is we're going to identify the wound. Now, physical wounds, we can think of an injury, we can think of a cut, a tear, a puncture, blunt force. Well, I think we could use all of those descriptors and think about emotional, spiritual, mental, psychological, blunt force, or tearing, ripping, or piercing, punching. Wounds can happen through active or aggressive means, such as abuse, insult. They can happen in passive ways, such as neglect or abandonment. We could think of abuse as misuse, relating in a way different than intended or designed for. A wound occurs when there is a non-loving interaction. Sometimes it's intended, sometimes it's unintended. It can happen physically. Slap, hit, punch, rape, cut, all kinds of ways we can mistreat. It can happen socially through shunning, humiliation. It can happen through mental name-calling, teaching falsehoods, lying. A gentleman I know was given a nickname in his home. The nickname is of a certain animal relieving themselves. And that was his name. My son Joy, my other son, this name. As you might imagine, that name came to be how he defined himself. That name became his predictor. This is how his life's going to develop. Emotional, shaming for having tears, shaming for crying, having anger and rage against you. Spontaneously, not related to anything in particular. Or spiritual abuse. We see an example of this in Matthew 23. And those exclamation marks there mean Jesus is saying this loudly and with force, where he's confronting those who would take God's good news and codify it into rules and regulations to follow so we can be self-sufficient and be in control. All of these cause wounds. Now, what are the consequences of these wounds? It alters the understanding of myself. It alters how I see who I am. It interferes with, it alters how I understand others. Is this person trustworthy? Can I take the risk to reveal myself? Can I let my guard down? Can I ever let my guard down? If I go draw close to you, will you leave me? Will you betray me? How do I predict? It alters our understanding. It distorts our understanding of truth. It distorts our understanding of God. I have head knowledge that says God is love. And all I feel is I'm on the verge of Sodom and Gomorrah. One more misstep and it's probably just going to wipe me off the face of the earth. It leaves us with these incongruencies, this tension inside. There's a second thing this does. Not only does it distort our understandings, it alters our physiology. Our body is different through the wounding. We have a guarded response. If the wound is highly significant at one time, we might have a very strong response. We're very activated, we're ready to fight or flee, we've got this hyper-arousal, hypersensitivity to any movement, etc., hypervigilance. But all of us become very tense and guarded when we are threatened. And this becomes associated even with who we are. We're changed as a result of this. Well, we can identify what the wound is. We're going to need to be able to define it and describe it, but then we've got to clean the wound. And this is the messy part. This is the part I'd rather not do. We've got to go through the pain. We've got to face the pain of my own thoughts, how I think, how I see the world, the pain about the realities that I fear. Not only how I think and what I know, I've got to face the pain about the feelings involved. Yes, this gentleman had to face the realities of being without a father and then functioning without a mother at age 13. But he also had to go through the emotional feelings of terror, of being scared, of being angry, but being all alone in his anger. We've got to also confront the lies we believe. The way that we have learned how to handle it at one point in life, if we keep using that same strategy, it doesn't fit anymore. It's not realistic. It's not truth-based. We have to confront that. Now, to go through the pain, we're going to face our emotions. Oh, what are emotions? Why do we bother having them? They seem to be more trouble than they're worth often. I'm going to offer you just a real quick picture of what emotions, how they function. They're given to us by God. Originally, I believe, before the fall, they were so ingrained with our thoughts that we wouldn't have called them something separate. But when sin entered in, it took things that were together and separated them. So we can think about emotions as our physical reactions to either something going on inside us or something outside us. We react to this that increases or decreases our energy. Anger increases our energy. Happiness increases our energy. Sadness decreases it. Takes our batteries out. Slows us way down. This energy change focuses our attention on what we need to do. Anger focuses our attention on what we perceive that is wrong. Sadness focuses our attention on what we've lost. With anger, we have more energy to address the problem. With sadness, we have less energy to face the reality of the loss. It changes our emotion. It focuses our attention. And this motivates us to take an action so that we can resolve it. Adjust to whatever we need to adjust to in our life. And when we make the adjustment, the emotion is released. Angry at something, identify what's wrong, I change my expectation about it, I set a boundary, whatever I need to do, it's resolved, I'm no longer angry. It's over. So with emotions, we want to identify them. The form of expression is not the end point, but that helps us get that energy and focus so we can decide what needs to be done so that we can resolve them and release them. We have to go through. Now, the Psalms offer so many good examples of this. Psalm 6, Psalms 13, two short ones. Read them. Hear the agony, hear the anger, hear the fear, hear the pain in the first part of the chapter. And in the last part of the chapter, see how they resolved it, how they went through the pain. I don't know how much time was between the first part and the second part, but we're given this as a whole to see the process. Got to go through the pain. Why? Pain, while it's aversive, it does motivate us. It does direct our attention to the problem. And while it hurts, it is not harmful. Now, that might surprise you. Pain does hurt. I don't like it. It is not harmful. Pain, in fact, is a signal. It signals us to something that is damaged, something that is violated, abused, broken, lost. And if we ignore the pain, we're going to see there's all kinds of consequences. We've got to go through it. One of the things we have to do is face that the pain is signaling something to us. Because if we avoid it, it blocks our adjustment. We get stuck. We don't go past it. It doesn't go away with time. It just gets more confused with time. It turns into bitterness with time. It is what it is. Reality stays the same whether we deal with it or not. Avoiding it does not change it. Avoiding, though, gives us an illusion of personal power, personal strength. Avoiding it gives us this false sense that I'm in control. But while we're avoiding, the problems are becoming more complicated and more difficult in our life. Avoiding isolates us from God, from each other, from ourselves. And we develop habits while we're avoiding that the habits in and of themselves become destructive. And so now I had problem A, but after some time of avoiding, I got problems A, B, and C. And I'm so focused on C, I can't even get to A. And I feel helpless, I feel overwhelmed, alone. So to try to get freedom from this emotional pain, we try all kinds of things. Instead of going through the pain, we may try to work excessively to have achievement and accomplishment and performance. We may try to compete athletically or compete in relationships or compete at work, lose ourselves in relationship. If I just had the perfect woman, everything would be okay. Yeah. Sex, if I could just be distracted by the elation. Substances, consume something, buy. All of these result in addictions. We humans, we can become addicted to just about anything. We're really good at this. And in the addictions, we're trying to avoid the pain by momentary escape, and we're creating bigger problems. We have to go through the pain. Now some, instead of going through it, they just dwell in it. Like, this is my new identity. Hi, I'm a guy in horrible pain. That's me. And in doing that, they may try to stay connected with what was lost. Because if I heal from this, it's like it never happened, or it's like it didn't matter. Like the intensity of their pain signifies something. Or they're fulfilling a prophecy that a parent may have given them or whatever. Dwelling in the pain does not lead to healing. But if we go through the pain, we can adjust to what we've lost, to live well without it, putting what we've lost in a place in our memory, in our heart, opening to be available to live in the present. We can be in reality. Just that and alone. Living in a fallen world, we have to go through the pain in order to stay in what's real. And what's real is where we're going to find Jesus. What's real is where God is going to be. A lot of times we can't find God because God's in the pain and we're saying, no, thank you, I'm going to stay over here on the shore. In order to be in what's real, we're going to have to go in. Notice in the incarnation, Jesus here on earth, not even God was able to stay out of the pain. In fact, God experienced pain in many times, in many ways. The most ultimate, of course, at the cross, but in relationships, in the death of Lazarus, and other places, that going through the pain we have demonstrated in the life of Jesus. In our lives, this is where we're going to be vulnerable. This is where God's going to touch us. If you want to know God personally, we have to go through. We don't get extra points, though, just for being in the pain. It's something we move through. And as we are, we start to see things a little more clearly. We need to sort out what happened to get a description. We need to discern responsibility. What is my responsibility? What is not mine? For what's mine, I need to take ownership of. But what's not mine, I need to release. Because I cannot forgive you for something I did. I cannot forgive me for something you did. In order for forgiveness to be implemented when there has been wrongdoing, there must be accurate discernment of who's responsible. And one of the reasons we don't have forgiveness at times is our minds are mush. We haven't sorted it out. We don't know. Well, how do we sort it out? I offer you this criteria. I'm responsible for how I treat myself and how I treat other people. I embrace this. This is my dignity. This is God entrusting a life with me. I am the manager or the steward of this life. I am not responsible for how other people treat me, how other people treat other people, or how other people treat themselves. I release this. That is them. I am responsible when I see someone in need what I do, but I'm not responsible for what they do. I need to sort this out. Sorting this out takes us from a sense of real confusion, often a sense of false blame or avoidance of responsibility, and allows us now to take actions where we can resolve this. I need to define what is real. Now, I'm going to describe here. Describing is not justifying. If I tell you that my third grade teacher humiliated me in front of class, and to this day I don't like to do math problems on the board, that's an accurate description. And you'll never see me do a math problem on the board, probably. Not that you wanted to. But who's responsible for me doing math problems on the board today? Is my third grade teacher? No. She doesn't even know. I don't know where she is. I have to manage that. I can describe how I acquired this shame reaction, but I am the one responsible to manage it today. You may notice I don't look like a third grader anymore. I don't need to treat myself like a third grader. But to understand why this is so challenging, I may need to define and describe and sort it out and confront the lies, confront shaming statements, falsehoods that may have been given to me. I need then to replace it with something. The truth. What is real? How does God see me? What is the truth? I need to make truth lists. I need to write this out. I need to talk with safe others. I need to review it myself. I need to journal. I need to hold on to what's real, the transforming, not just of my intellect, but of my emotion, my spirit as well. I need to allow others in. I need to learn how to let them know me, to see me from behind this facade, to find out who they are, to see them. I need to stretch beyond myself to invest in lives of others. Part of this cleaning is to be known and to know others, to exercise love. Now, the bandage. We've got to contain this. And in containing it, we're going to have boundaries. And you've heard this term probably, boundaries. Often we think of a fence or a line. Well, a boundary we can think of as telling you, telling myself, telling others what I will do. Revealing myself to somebody else. That is setting a boundary. I will do this. I won't do this. A boundary is about the life God has given me to manage. A boundary is not about somebody else. That might be a directive, a command, an ultimatum, a threat. It's not a boundary. So I will take responsibility for the life God's given me to manage, and I will operate from that vantage point. I'm not going to be able to control another's behavior. I'm not called to do that. I am called to manage how I respond when others do whatever they're going to do. And that's where dignity comes back in. I need to manage my physical arousal. Some things get me upset. Some things cause me tension. Some things cause me to get irritable. Yes, it's predictable. But I am responsible for how I treat myself. Learn how to relax, to calm our body, to calm our mind and our soul. Learn how to decrease that arousal, manage my emotion. I need to bring forgiveness in. Now, some things that happen are just preference issues. Oh, I wish that wouldn't happen. I like green better than blue. But usually those aren't the things that wound us. Typically, where we've had wounds is where there's been wrongdoing. And wrongdoing isn't something we can accept. We cannot honestly say, no, that's okay. They meant well. And the truth may be they didn't mean well. But the wound occurred. And if we don't resolve it, we carry bitterness, sort of the sauerkraut of emotions, anger just left to rot. We carry that with us if we don't resolve it. So in forgiveness, we're looking at choosing not to give consent to it. We'll acknowledge what happened, but we're going to change our motivation to a love motivation. Everett Worthington has developed what's called a REACH model of forgiveness. I encourage you to look that up. Everett Worthington's his name. Excellent how-to. He talks about recalling the hurt, going through the pain, then empathize with the one who hurt you. Restore their humanity. Understand what it was like from their angle. Not to justify, but recognize they are as sinful as I am. They are as in need of forgiveness as I am. They need forgiveness also. Give the altruistic gift. Unearned forgiveness is not because they earned it, but because the forgiver is choosing. And we can forgive others because God has forgiven us. But then we decide to do it, we make a commitment. At this point, forgiveness is implemented. Now, that doesn't mean I feel great about it. That means from this point on, I relate to this wrongdoing through the lens of forgiveness instead of any other. The rest of my life, I hold on to forgiveness. I interpret the situation through that lens. I need to build relationships now in truth with peers to know and be known. And then finally, the last part of our activity here in healing, the bandages come off, forgiveness is being lived out. Now I need to live all of my life. I need to go out. I need to stretch. I need to extend beyond. I need to live in the fullness. I need to live well in the present. I want to close with this observation of Jesus. What can I anticipate as I go through this? A freedom to love the Lord with my heart, my soul, my mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. The process of healing, an implementation of love. I thank you for your attention. We've got just a couple of minutes. If there were some questions. The question is, do I have the notes available? And right now, to me, I do. To you, if you want to sign up, I can email. I don't mind emailing them to you. I'll have a sheet out here. Yes?
I have a question. Why did the easy thing done about leaving happen and go on in life?
I'm sorry?
I said, why is it that it's easy said and done, we been through in the past? For me, I never knew in my childhood what I knew now.
Uh-huh.
Even with my father, I never knew my father.
Uh-huh.
And how can I forgive him? He never asked me forgiveness.
And that's a very common question. How can I forgive someone who's never asked me forgiveness? And one of the things I'm going to draw to your attention to, forgiveness is given by the forgiver. It's not earned. It's not deserved. It's not something that the person can work for to achieve. Forgiveness changes the one doing the forgiving. The one who's being forgiven may accept it, and it will change. They may reject it. But forgiveness comes from the forgiver. And remember our source of forgiveness. We can forgive because we are forgiven. Last question. The book by Everett Worthington on forgiveness, he has a couple. Excuse me?
Forgiveness and Reconciliation is beginning to title.
Forgiveness and Reconciliation is a very good one of his. I just go to Amazon.com and put in Worthington and get. Okay, I think we're going to need to close at this point.
Do you have the book where you've been talking about today?
No, there's not a book for this per se. But again, I thank you.
Hey, guys, all the talks that you have heard should be downloadable on the website. The website's located in the front of your brochure. Let's give Dan a thanks for putting together.
Yeah, the website.
Stop by and see some of the pools before you go. Yeah, email. Well done, sir.
Yep. Okay, thank you.